7:13. Cooks a breakfast of 2 fried eggs, 1 rasher of bacon, and a piece of whole wheat toast. 7:21. Sits in the chair of Digger Station, cuts her breakfast into small squares, and eats it 1 square at a time.
I'm eating bacon now!
She yells in between mouthfuls. 7:43. Sits on the chair of discernment. She watches the street through the hole in the ivy, her body leaning forward, her hands gripping her knees.
Too frickly!
She might shriek at a passerby, jumping out of her chair and pointing her finger in the air as if playing bingo.
Too Asian! Too bald! Pull your pants up! Stupid shoes! Too many hair clips! Thin lips! Suit too purple! Pointy nose! Asymmetrical face! Knobbly knees!
Sometimes the insults extend to the neighbours' yards.
Cut your hedges! Too many flowers! Letterbox is slanty!
Or even the birds.
Too chirpy! Not enough legs!
The words rebound off the walls of the room, and her voice becomes louder and louder, culminating in one final, all-encompassing insult that never seems to have the effect she wants.
Humanity is doomed!
12:15. Collapses in a heaving lump on her chair. 12:16. Allows herself to be sweaty and relieved. 12:18. Lunch. A whole wheat Vegemite sandwich. Does not cut it into squares like her breakfast. Instead, cuts it into long, thin strips.
Variety is important. If you want to keep your wits about you,
she yells as she dangles a sandwich strip above her mouth. 12:47. Afternoon tea. A pot of tea and an Anzac biscuit. Sits in the hallway on the chair of resentment. Looks at the brown wall and yells things like,
loud lawnmowers!
And
nosy neighbours!
Sometimes she can't think of anything and just says,
brown walls!
Being resentful makes her face feel more pointed than usual, and for reasons she can't quite put into words, she gleans satisfaction from this feeling.
I like this feeling!
She confirms to the wall. 1:32. Cleans the house, yelling,
I'm scrubbing the coat hangers!
Or,
I'm polishing the light globes!
3:27. Sits in the chair of disagreement in the sitting room and writes complaint letters, keeping them in a box marked, for distribution after all of this. She underlines this, but is not specific about what this is. 4:29. One of two things happens. Sits in the chair of disappearing, closes her eyes, and listens to the ksh sound from the television. Or, very, very occasionally, sits in the chair of disappointment and stares at her husband's slippers. 5:03. Dinner. A roast, usually. Covers the meat, potatoes, and broccoli with gravy. 6:16. Sits in the chair of disengagement. Drinks a mug of Bonox and watches television static. 8:00. Removes all her clothes.
Shoes! Blouse! Stockings!
And hangs them up. 8:06. Sits in the chair of disbelief and stares at herself in the mirror. 8:12. Puts on her nightgown and turns off the light. It is only in the dark of night that Agatha removes her brown sunglasses, but even then it's only in her bed when she pulls the blanket up over her face, squeezing her eyes tightly closed. And even then the world feels too close, hovering above her only centimetres away. And in the soft seconds between asleep and awake, that tiny gap in consciousness where you are just awake enough to know and just asleep enough not to know, at around 9:23 p.m. Agatha Panther allows herself to be lonely. But today, at 10:36 a.m, everything changes. 6 a.m. wakes, fumbles for her brown glasses. 6:05 to 6:45. Sits in the chair of disbelief and yells,
"I'm counting wrinkles now! I don't think I've seen this one on my knee before." She writes, "New kinkle," under a wrinkle count. 6:47. "I'm turning on the water now," she yells, standing in the shower.
7:06.
"Stockings, skirt, blouse, shoes."
7:22.
"I'm eating eggs now."
7:56. Sits in the chair of discernment.
"Parking too far away from the gutter."
8:30.
"Flowers aren't growing."
9:16.
"Footpath is dirty."
10:12.
"Helmets aren't fashion accessories."
10:36. A police car drives slowly past.
"This is different," she yells.
10:42. The same police car drives down the street from the other direction.
"That too!"
10:47. A small girl with curly red hair runs down the street, opens Agatha's front gate, runs into Agatha's front yard, and hides behind Agatha's fence.
"What?"
Agatha yells. 10:48. The police car drives past again. The girl sinks into the weeds, her back against the fence. She looks at Agatha.
"What?"
Agatha yells. 10:49. The little girl peeks over the fence, looks up and down the street, looks back at Agatha, stands, walks out of Agatha's front yard, across the street, and up the pathway of the opposite house. She tries the door, finds a key under the mat, turns back to look up and down the street, and disappears inside the house. 10:50.
"What?"
Agatha yells. Agatha has been watching this house. 3 months ago, she saw the ambulance arrive with the lights off. She saw the white sheet over the stretcher, the vague lines of a body. She saw the street rally round them, carrying their, "Thank God it was you and not me," food. She saw the florist vans parked down the street in a long line. She saw the mother shrinking down to bones.
"You should eat some of the food they keep bringing you," she yelled at her once, tapping on the window.
She saw the child. She was just a child.
"I'll leave you alone," she had yelled. "It'll be the best thing for you."
She leaned back in her chair and folded her arms.
"Trust me."
So, when Agatha sees the little girl disappear into the house, on the other side of the road, she knows that the little girl's father is dead and that her mother isn't home. The mother had looked at Agatha 2 days ago, right through the hole in the ivy, right through the glass of the window, right in the eyes. She'd put a suitcase in the boot of her car, and her eyes said something to Agatha, something like an apology, something like screaming, something like pleading, something like this. "How do you get old without letting sadness become everything?" And Agatha's body had vibrated a little. Agatha hadn't understood what was happening, but she could tell something was happening.
"Something's happening here! Something's awry!" she yelled, standing up and pressing the side of her face against the glass,
watching the mum and the little girl drive off down the street. Agatha could feel it. There was something happening. 11:37. Agatha tries to forget all about the little girl's return. She tries to forget the mother's face and the fact that there is no car in the driveway. She tries to focus on all the houses that she can see, except for the one opposite.
"Lawn is patchy," she yells. I can see a weed just there. Your dog's ugly. Too many kids. They're ugly too.
But then the door across the road opens. The little girl appears. Agatha watches her cross the road, open Agatha's gate, and walk up her driveway.
What?
Agatha yells. The little girl knocks on Agatha's front door. She's holding a piece of paper.
No thanks,
Agatha yells through the window.
I've got enough.
The little girl disappears and then returns, brandishing a plastic crate. She maneuvers it in front of Agatha's window and stands on it, so she is face to face with Agatha through the glass. The little girl holds up the piece of paper.
What's this?
She asks. Agatha squints at it.
If I tell you, will you go away?
The little girl nods.
It's a travel itinerary.
What's that?
It's a piece of paper that says where someone's going. Is that your mother's name?
The little girl nods again.
She went to Melbourne 2 days ago.
Agatha pauses.
And she's going to the United States in 6 days.
They stare at each other through the glass.
Now go away.
The next day. 7:43. The little girl stands at the window of the house across the road, watching Agatha. They stare at each other. The little girl's eyes say something like,
How do you get old?
8:07. Agatha hangs a pillowcase over the window so she can't see through the hole in the ivy. 9:13. There's a knock on the window. Agatha jumps.
I'm hungry,
a small voice says. Agatha turns the volume up full bore on the television. Ksh! 12:15. Agatha removes the pillowcase. The little girl is still watching her from the window across the road, but now she sits in a chair. 3:27. Agatha tries to write complaint letters, but all she can think of to write is,
Dear little girl's mum, who do you think you are?
4:16. The child is still looking at her through the window. Agatha can't concentrate. All she can think about is the mother's face, the carless driveway. Before she knows what she's doing, she has waded through the letters and opened the door. She's holding some Anzacs and a cup of tea. The air is so fresh on her face, on her whole body. She hasn't felt fresh air on her whole body like this since. She can feel it blowing on her legs, feel it through her stockings, her skin prickles, her breath catches.
This is different.
The weeds around her front door are at head height, and they greet her like a group of malnourished people.
You're not getting anything from me,
she yells, swinging her elbows at them as she storms past. She stands at her front gate and faces the street.
Too many cracks in the footpath, she yells. I'm crossing the road now. Hedge is too fancy. Look out, car. I'm not stopping for you. This is not that hard at all. It's just walking, after all. I've done it a million times. As long as I have legs that can walk, I should probably use them.
Agatha walks up the pathway to the little girl's house and knocks on the door. The little girl answers it.
Hello,
the little girl says. Agatha hands her the plate of biscuits and the cup of tea. The little girl stares at the offerings.
Well,
Agatha says. The little girl takes the plate but ignores the tea.
Have you rung your mother?
The little girl places the plate on a nearby table and starts eating a biscuit. She won't meet Agatha's eyes.
Her phone's off.
Relatives, then.
Agatha looks at the cup of tea, then sips it.
Any of those?
My auntie lives out east, the little girl says. Melbourne.
Agatha feels like a giant looming over her. Was she ever this small?
But Mum says we don't need anyone else.
Oh, she did she? tried your auntie?
I don't know her number.
Don't you have an address book?
Mum had it in her phone.
Look it up in the white pages.
What are white pages?
What's her name?
Judy.
Judy what?
Auntie Judy.
Auntie Judy! From Melbourne!
Agatha turns and walks back down the pathway.
What am I supposed to do with that?
She throws one arm up in the air, the tea splashing over the edges of the cup. The little girl runs after her.
My dad died.
Yeah, well.
Agatha turns around to face the girl.
So did mine.
She sips her tea forcefully.
When did he die?
60 years ago.
Mine died 3 months ago.
This isn't a competition, but if it was, I've lived without mine for longer than you, so.
What happened at his funeral?
What kind of question is that?
Mum didn't let me go to Dad's funeral.
Well, that was probably the best thing for you.
Why are you yelling?
Why are you whispering?
I'm not.
Neither am I.
Agatha turns to cross the street, but stops short. She stares at the house across from them. She takes another forceful sip of tea.
I live there?
The little girl nods.
But it's...
Agatha can't finish the sentence. It's the house in the street that children would be frightened of, that adults would have scorn or pity for. She turns back to the girl.
You're sure I live there?
The girl nods again.
Can you help me find my mum? She says.
Of course not, Agatha says. I have things to do. I'm very busy. Go to the police.
I can't. They want to give me a new mum and a new dad.
Go back inside,
Agatha yells, striding toward her house.
Keep trying your mother.
6:16. Sits in the chair of disengagement. Drinks a mug of Bonox. And watches television static. 6:24. The television static begins to look like the little girl's face. 6:25. Pours the remainder of her Bonox down the sink. 6:26. Removes all her clothes.
Shoes, blouse, stockings.
And hangs them up. 6:31. Sits in the chair of disbelief. And stares at herself in the mirror. 6:33. Her face becomes the little girl's face. She accidentally knocks the portable clock off the bathroom bench, and it smashes on the tiles. 6:33 to 6:45. Stares at the smashed clock. 6:46. Puts on her nightgown and turns off the light. And the next day, 5:36 p.m. Agatha knocks on the little girl's front door and hands her a plate piled with roast meat, potatoes, broccoli and gravy.
Thank you,
the little girl says, and begins to eat from the plate with her fingers while standing.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
The little girl says, face already covered in gravy.
You should be outside, playing. You're just a child. Don't sit at the window.
You do that.
But I'm old. I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to do whatever I want. That's what happens when you get old. Write that down. It's important.
I'm hiding.
From who?
Helen. Stan. My new mum and dad. The police.
Agatha stares at her.
What did you do?
I don't know,
the little girl says, and starts to cry. 8:12. Agatha puts on her nightgown and turns off the light. As she's climbing into bed, she trips over something soft. She turns on the light. 8:13. She has kicked her husband's slippers across the room. 8:14. Agatha turns on the bathroom light and looks at herself in the mirror. She starts feeling it again, that thing rising up her throat.
She's talking me into it,
she yells. And the day after that? 6 a.m. Agatha has had enough. 7:43. She packs her large handbag with everything she needs. Her age book, two watches, and a small battery-run clock from the cupboard. Spare underwear, two blouses, some Anzac biscuits, her jar of Bonox, her notepad for writing complaint letters. 8:12. Agatha knocks on the little girl's front door. She grips her handbag tightly and has her suit jacket buttoned up.
"Have you tried your mother again?"
Agatha says when the little girl opens the door. The little girl looks at her feet.
Her phone's still off.
The first sign of one of those telephone machines, you're ringing her.
The little girl notices Agatha's handbag.
Where are you going?
And you'll be ringing her the entire way. She can't get away with it that easily.
Are you taking me somewhere?
If you think I'm getting on one of those jet planes, you can think again.
Pardon me?
And I can't take you to the police. I know what they do to women like me, who live in places like that.
She gestures toward her house.
They'll lock me up, put me in some home with all the dribbling people.
The little girl looks unsure and doesn't move.
Don't just stand there. Pack your bags. We're going to Melbourne.
The little girl disappears for a moment and returns with a backpack.
Is that it?
She picks up a long plastic object that lies on the ground beside the door and nods.
What on earth is that?
Agatha says. The little girl hugs it to her chest.
It's a leg.
Carl the Touch Typist. Carl did not own a computer, typewriter, or even a keyboard. He touch-typed on garbage bin lids, on air, on the heads of small children, on his legs. He typed questions out with his fingertips before he asked them, just to make sure he wanted to. In the privacy of his own home, before he moved in with his son, Carl drew keyboards on coffee tables, on walls, on his shower curtains. He loved the way typing made hands move. The way fingers square danced around one another doing the do-si-do. He'd watched his mother's fingers. Then eventually Evie's bouncing off the keys like drops of water on hot asphalt, and found the crooked typing finger of a woman to be as elegant and arousing as the arch of her foot or the nape of her neck. When Carl's son said goodbye in the nursing home, he said, "We'll see you soon, Dad," and kissed him on the cheek. Carl felt his son's scratchy face against his, and it was suddenly unfathomable to him that his own son had to shave. Life had been one blink and one breath and one piss, and now he was here, sitting on a bed in a room full of old men who couldn't keep their shit to themselves. He stood at the window and watched his son cross the parking lot. He walked so deliberately, that boy, from heel to toe, always, and Carl thought, when did he decide to walk like that? Evie's footsteps had been so light and unpredictable, like salt falling from a salt shaker. His son seemed conscious that each step was bringing him closer to something of which he was unsure. Heel to toe, heel to toe. It was his daughter-in-law Amy's idea. "I walk into my own house and brace myself to see a dead man in the recliner," he heard her say one night through the papery walls that separated their bedrooms. She was a pointy little woman, one whose perfume always arrived before she did. "He's my father," his son Scott replied. "I'm your wife," she paused. "You know what the doctor said about my blood pressure?" There was a long silence, and Carl lay in his bed with his arms straight at his sides as though he were waiting to be shot out of a cannon. "Okay," his son said finally. Carl squeezed his fingers together. "I'll talk to him." Carl turned his head to one side and felt the pillow on his cheek. He squinted into the darkness. "Evie," he whispered, and held out his hand like a peace offering. He traced her body in the air with an open palm. He tried to feel her nose on his, her breath on his face, her hand across his back. "Evie," he said again, because it was the only word that came to mind. He put his palm on the pillow by his head and closed his eyes. When Scott and Amy rose for work the next morning, Carl was already sitting at the dining table with his bag packed at his feet. He wore his hat and the gloves he'd once used for driving. "Dad," Scott said, stopping in the kitchen doorway. Carl cleared his throat.
I think I'm ready to move on," he said,
fingers tapping on the table. Scott pulled out the chair beside him and sat down. Carl laced his fingers together. Scott placed a careful hand on top of Carl's. As he ran a gloved thumb over his son's knuckle, Carl thought, "I made this hand." Carl sat on the edge of his bed. He was in a room with four other men. The pallid colour of their skin seemed to match the pallid colour of the walls. They all lay in their beds with a kind of stunned boredom, their mouths open, their eyes blinking as if they had to remind themselves to do it.
"So,"
Carl said out loud,
"this is it."
A nurse stopped in the doorway and eyed him.
"You gonna unpack, love?"
"Of course," he replied. "Just getting my sea legs."
The nurse smiled. She had a pretty smile.
"Take your time,"
she said, leaning into the doorframe.
"But we're serving dinner in an hour."
She winked at him and turned on her heel, her ponytail flicking at the air. Her bum jiggled beneath her uniform as she walked away. It was still light outside when Carl walked down the hallway to the dining hall for dinner. The clock on the wall said 4:30. And as a plateful of unidentifiable foodstuffs was pushed in front of him, Carl thought,
"So this is it."
He sat at a long table, like the sort he'd seen in movies about prison. He still wore his driving gloves and hat. The jiggly-bummed nurse pulled up a chair beside him. She grabbed his hand and looked into his eyes.
"Okay, love?"
she asked. He couldn't remember the last time someone had looked at him like they meant it. He closed his eyes and allowed himself this moment. She had dark hair, dark eyes, pale skin. She was so clean, he thought.
Another time, another place, I would kiss her.
Being able to rest his nose in her cleavage would make this place bearable. Instead, he just looked back at her with his old man eyes. He said, typing into her palm,
"Yes, thank you."
His body felt pathetic in comparison to hers, so old and shrunken. But she looked at him with a type of kindness that made him forget that. And then she stood up and jiggled away. And he sat there, looking at what might have been mashed peas, thinking about how much he wanted her to jiggle on top of him, right in this chair, in front of everybody. No one would even notice. And as he surrendered to the peas, spooning them into his mouth, feeling them sink down his throat, he thought, "I never do what I want to do." These are the things Carl knows about. Touch typing. When Carl was a tiny boy, thinking enormous thoughts, he would sometimes pretend he was sick so he could accompany his mother to work. She worked in a big room full of typing women, and Carl would sit underneath her, the top of his head touching the bottom of her chair, the perfect line of her legs in front of him, pushed together with such tenacity you would need a crowbar to pry them open. But there was still a sweetness about them, somewhere in the roundness of her calves. He only remembers his mother in bits and pieces now, in legs, and fingers and reflections in mirrors. The women had seemed otherworldly to him, like something that might be kept in a glass case or on a wall. He closed his eyes underneath his mother's chair and listened. The typing was loud and unforgiving. All these pretty women, their bodies perfectly still, their fingers warring against typewriters. Things began to advance for Carl when he learned the term, touch typing. He realized that women didn't have to look at their fingers to make them move in such dramatic ways. This made him feel something he didn't understand. He didn't know it was all about his own skin until he met Evie. Years later, after his first day at typing school, Carl sat at the kitchen table and plunged the tips of his fingers into a bowl of ice. They were red and throbbing, but it was nice to see pain on his fingertips and feel it running up his forearms, like something trying to get inside him. It felt nice to have something trying to get inside him. For the first time in his life, he felt in a position of power, in the decisive way he was forced to use his fingers. The keys flew at the page, thwap, 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 like he was throwing punches. He loved the potential of those white pages, that they would start off as nothing and become something. It made him feel as if he, too, could become something. By day, he filled pages with meaningless sentences about cats and dogs, and Jack and Jill and Jane. He typed them as though they were the most important things anyone ever had to say. By night, he dreamed in typing exercises. In the morning, he sang the exercises into the showerhead, closing his eyes and letting the water run down his face. His mind lit up in letters as he spoke. He loved watching his fingers skidding across the keys. He could see that perhaps he was beautiful, because he was creating something. It wasn't music they played in concert halls or art they hung on walls, but to Carl it was both of those things and more. Evie. Carl had met Evie at typing school. Eventually he would come to like the way she clutched at her chest when she talked, as if she were trying to stop her heart from falling out. When they first met, however, he simply thought her name would be good to say during sex. There was something excitingly sacrilegious in the way he could tie original sin and sex together. He had, of course, known her as Eve back then. Evie would come later, when he knew her knees and elbows and belly button better than he knew his own. Her name had, from the very beginning, felt incomplete without the I, E, kind of hanging there, with a drama that seemed unnecessary. After 2 months, there had been 3 conversations. The eyes, the touches, that walk she did with those hips he couldn't blink out of his mind. If she was in the room, he couldn't think of anything else but her presence. Her heat and energy were so noticeable to him. It wasn't just his mind running through the various things that would happen once she gave him permission to know her. It was also his body. He felt it needing to be near her, as though his skin was going to burst into flames if they didn't touch. One night she pirouetted out the door after class, her eyes resting on him. Carl sat in front of his typewriter thinking, Eve's fingers, Eve's hands, Eve's smile, Eve's hair. When the last straggler had filed out, he removed with great difficulty the letters M, A, R, Y, and E from his typewriter. He calmly walked to Eve's desk and removed the R and M from hers. He glued the letters to the tips of his fingers, Mary on his right hand, me on his left, and appeared on her doorstep in the fading light. He held his hands up on either side of his face, wriggling his fingers a little. She put her hands on his forearm and typed, Yes, thank you. Their wedding day was simple. Nothing too grand, nothing too quiet. Nothing went wrong, really, unless you count the organist fainting at his post mid Here Comes the Bride, but even that was okay, because when his head fell onto the keys and that terrible sound of discordant notes crunched together, echoing throughout the church like a moment of suspense in a film, it made Carl feel as though his life was worthy of suspense and worthy of film. Carl stood at the front of the church, feeling the sweat gather in the lines on his palms, feeling the eyes of the typing women seated across 2 pews, looking like birds on a wire. Their legs were all crossed identically, and everything about them seemed so conscious of the angle of their tilted heads, and he thought,
Have these women always been like this?
There was something about them that made him uneasy. And then Evie stood opposite him, looking at him so warmly from her plain, unremarkable face. He loved that plain, unremarkable face. The smattering of freckles, the uninteresting nose, the thin lips, the ordinary eyes. When quizzed about Evie's appearance, Carl had trouble describing it. He knew the derogatory implications of the word plain, so instead he lied and said she was pretty. Women were funny, he knew, not hilarious, but strange and unpredictable. They saw every possible implication of a word, like a prism refracting the light, making too many patterns on the wall. He had learned from an early age to say little and pretend he was slow. When you don't say much, Carl discovered, women assume you're deep and mysterious. They don't, for whatever reason, assume you're stupid. Her dress was a dull white, and there were no patterns on it, like the reams of paper he threaded through the typewriters day in, day out. The wedding ring he gave her was customized, a plain silver band with an ampersand typewriter key attached to it in place of a stone. Later that night, as he removed her dress in the glow of moonlight and lay it on the bed as though it were her, he typed on the fabric, "I am so glad I met you, Evie." But he didn't type like he was warring with the fabric or throwing punches. He typed delicately, as if he were typing into liquid and trying not to make any splashes. And when he typed, "I am here, Evie," across her collarbone, so softly he was barely touching her, she put her lips to his ear and whispered, "Me too." Love. In their life together, Carl and Evie didn't go anywhere, ever. They were each other's foreign countries.
"Only unhappy people leave home," Evie declared.
"And we don't need to leave," he said, typing on her forearm.
"Yes," she said, resting her forehead on his chin. "We don't need to leave."
They lived such a small life. Trees and flowers and oceans and neighbours. They never scaled mountains or braved rapids or went on telly. They never ate strange animals in Asian countries. They never starved themselves or set themselves on fire for the greater good. They never delivered a rousing speech, sang in a musical, or fought in a boxing ring. Their names wouldn't be in textbooks for children. Their faces wouldn't be on banknotes. They would not get their own statue. And when they died, their names would disappear like their last breath, a curiosity for cemetery-goers and nothing more. But they had loved. They grew plants, drank tea in the afternoon light, waved at neighbours. They watched Sail of the Century every night, and together were reasonably accomplished at it. They exchanged Christmas gifts with their butcher, their fruiterer, and their baker. Carl gave an old typewriter to the young, highly literate boy working at the newsagent. Evie made mittens for the girls working the morning shift at the supermarket. Carl was a guest in the local grade 6 class talking about the history of their town. Evie was a guest in the local year 7 class demonstrating how to make a pavlova. Carl fiddled about in his shed, Evie fiddled about in the kitchen. They went for looping walks in the morning and evening through local bushland, through the town, along the shoreline. Their life was a 20-kilometer radius around their house. Death. He remembers not being able to talk to her as she lay there at the mercy of machinery and starchy sheets. His words in the air without hers were horrifying. She was sleeping. She was always sleeping. She would open her eyes occasionally, but they reeled like a newborn's. So he had stood up and pulled back the sheet that had been so tightly enclosed around her, as though someone wanted to trap her there, pin her to this bed, like a specimen of the almost dead. He rested his hands on her arm. Just bone, really, nothing much more. And he typed, softer than breath, "I am here, Evie." and then walked around to the other side of the bed and rested his palms on her other arm, and her skin was not her skin. There were bruises up this arm, so purple with such definite edges, like maps of little-known countries, and he thought, "You are my foreign country." But he typed, "I am here, Evie." And then he lifted up her hospital gown to just above her knees. And her thighs were just nothing. They were just nothing. And he rested his open palms on one and felt so much nothingness. And he was crying now. He couldn't help it. He was so weak. He was so weak. There was just so much nothingness. And he thought about making nothing into something, and he typed with force and flair this time, watching his fingers the way they moved on her skin. He so desperately wanted her to feel the beauty of what his fingers were doing, and he typed, "I am here, Evie, I am here, Evie, I am here, Evie," over and over again, all the way down her thigh, over her knee, down her shin, like a line of ants marching down her leg, and he leaned over the bed and typed down her other leg, "I am here, Evie," and then moved to the bottom of the bed and held her feet, her very, very cold feet, in his fists, as small children hold crayons. And he was holding them so hard as he'd ever held anything, but she didn't move. She didn't notice. She didn't even stir. "I am here, Evie. I am here, Evie. I am here, Evie." Sadness. In the days following Evie's death, Carl whispered the words, "My wife's dead," in the mirror, preparing for some sort of audience. He pictured the woman from the post office, the next-door neighbour, his brother. He loved the feel of their imagined discomfort, the power it gave him. It somehow made all that had happened worthwhile, as though he had gained some sort of secret power through the death of his wife. He slept in their wardrobe, looking up at her clothes like he was gazing at the stars. They hung over him like apparitions, the lack of her so obvious in the thinness of these clothes. It felt as though he were lying under a guillotine, long, thin strands of cloth that would surely kill him somehow. He dreamed of her, of course he did, and woke up thinking, "That is the only time I'll see her now." He stood up in the darkness and leaned into her clothes, with his arms out like he was flying. Her clothes were so cold. He had remembered every morning since she died, woken up and the shock of remembering. He didn't want to sleep anymore because he didn't want to forget, because the remembering was harder. It was so physical. He sat on the toilet seat and stared at her bathroom things. The things she once spread on her skin or sprayed in the air or massaged into her hair. He brought the big saucepan in from the kitchen. He emptied all of her bottles into it. Her perfumes, moisturizers, hand creams, body balms, pill bottles. He mixed them together with his hands. The smell was awful, like something out of a department store, but the feeling between his fingers thrilled him. He dug his hands in deep, up to his elbows, mixed all her creams and smells together. Her empty bottles were strewn all over the bathroom tiles like carcasses. He squelched his hands together, making fart sounds. He did it over and over again, and let the brown mixture spurt out of the pan and onto the mirror, onto his face, onto the walls. He picked up the pan and sat it on their bed. "My bed," he thought. He hovered his hand over her pillow, as though he could draw her out from the bed with his hand magnets. Light brown goo dripped on the pillowcase. He took his clothes off and threw them on the ground. He hoisted himself up on the bed and stood, teetering a little on the mattress, careful not to bump his head on the overhead light. He lifted the pan up to his belly, breathed in, closed his eyes, his mouth, and then raised the pan higher and poured the entire contents onto his head. He gasped. It felt like he'd jumped into a river in the depths of winter. He opened his eyes. The goo ran down his face and neck, and he shivered. He threw the pan against the wall, and it made a satisfying crash. His son had found him hours later in the backyard, lying on his back on the concrete, basking in the sun, completely naked, except for dollops of brown goo all over his body, hardening like a crust on his skin. After dinner on his first night at the nursing home, he sat in the TV room with some of the other guests and watched That Was Whack, a movie set in an American high school. He'd never seen an exclamation mark in a movie title before, and the title didn't make any sense to him. But he certainly found the film compelling. The main character was a young man named Branson Spike. He was not conventionally handsome. However, once you looked at him for long enough, you found a sweetness to the way he behaved that wasn't offensive, that was in fact endearing. Branson Spike didn't understand the way his peers behaved or his position in the world, but he tried, and this seemed to be the point. Life in That Was Whack was pool parties and midterms, and how Veronica believed you fared on V's body aptitudinal test, where the body parts of fellow students were scrutinized in agonizing detail and marked, often ungraciously, out of 10. Branson Spike just wanted to fit in, just wanted to find a girl, just wanted to be cool enough. Just wanted, with hilarious and sometimes regrettable results. During an ad break, Carl looked around him. The room smelled of cleaning products and vomit. A woman sat in an armchair doing her knitting, which was a reasonable and comforting enough scenario had she been one of those soft, rounded women with pink cheeks, a gaggle of grandchildren at her feet to knit for, a sparkle in her eye, some scones in the oven. But she seemed to Carl to be knitting her own umbilical cord to the living, knitting so she wouldn't die. She looked at the television blankly, hunched over the tangled mess of knitting, like an animal crouched at a river. The man seated next to him on the couch made a gurgling sound in his throat every few minutes. He turned to Carl and stared. There had been an attempt to shave his face, but it wasn't a very good one. Clean, tight stubble was interspersed with surprising spikes of hair. "Bleh," the man said. "Indeed," Carl said. Two other men were seated at a nearby table attempting to play cards. One of them had fallen asleep in his chair, his head lolling back. The other one hadn't noticed, or didn't care, and shifted cards around in his hands, mumbling listlessly to himself. Carl turned back to the television. An ad for a footy game, a reality television show, face cream, cream cheese, a fast food restaurant, united in their central message, "You are not enough." It all made Carl feel small, heavy, colourless. "Who were you?" he thought, looking at the knitter, the gurgler, the card sharks. "Weren't you someone once?" He felt a vortex of past tense sucking him in. He avoided eye contact, he didn't introduce himself, he didn't want to make friends. He felt as far away from them as he did from the young Americans on the telly. And yet, as Carl watched the exploits of Branson Spike and his peers thrillingly unfold, he felt an overwhelming closeness to the boy. As Branson Spike pined after Veronica Hodges, the most popular girl in school, Carl felt his body tensing. He found himself unable to relax. He so desperately wanted Branson Spike to be loved. He could see that hope in Branson Spike's eyes, that hope for the one woman. Carl knew that all it took was one, just one, who you could grab onto like a buoy in the sea, who could help you float, stop you from drowning. You were still in the sea, but it didn't matter because you could hold her, lie on your back and float, look up at the sky and marvel at the things you may have missed, the day, the night, the clouds, the stars, the feeling of the ocean lapping beneath you. And he thought, "Come on, Branson Spike." The beautiful Veronica Hodges was not that woman, as it turned out. Turned out that the woman was his best friend, Joan Peters, who had been there all along. Cute, mousy, reliable. There. And Carl had found Evie, and Branson Spike had found Joan Peters. But what would happen to Branson Spike when she left him? For a job offer, for someone else? To die? What happened to Carl? As the credits rolled, he caught his reflection in the black of the television screen. What will happen to Carl? He thought. Later, Carl sat upright in his bed, in the darkness. The lights had been turned off hours ago, but he couldn't bring himself to lie down. He felt like if he did, he would never wake up, or that he would become one of them. There seemed a depressing choreography to the smacking lips and whistling noses and rasping breaths that surrounded him. He thought, I don't matter anymore. And then with stinging clarity, have I ever mattered? He had become blank. But there was not the expectation of something blank like a page or a canvas. There was not the hope and fear and wonder that blankness can sometimes create. There was just nothing. In the world of punctuation, he might have been a dash, floating in between, not necessarily required. Carl wanted to feel again. He wanted to walk onto a crowded bus and make eye contact with a woman with brown hair, blonde hair, blue hair. Just hair would be enough, and feel that flip in his stomach, that nice hurt. He wanted to laugh loudly, to lean over his knees with it, to throw grapes at someone, to sit in a mud puddle, to yell things, any things, it didn't matter. He wanted to pull down a woman's skirt, to sit on the bonnet of a moving car, to wear shorts, to eat with his mouth open. He wanted to write love letters to women, tons of them. He wanted to see some lesbians. He wanted to swear loudly, in public. He wanted an unattainable woman to break his heart. He wanted a foreigner to touch him on the arm, man or woman, it didn't matter. He wanted biceps. He wanted to give someone something big, not meaningful, just huge. He wanted to jump and try to touch something way out of his reach. He wanted to pick a flower, to pick his nose. He wanted to hit something really very hard. And he thought, when did I stop doing things and start remembering them instead? And so Carl the touch typist pushed back the covers. He maneuvered himself to the edge of the bed and kicked off his slippers, one and then the other, kicking them off like a child would upon reaching the homestead after a day at school, no care for where they might land. One slipper went straight up into the air, flipping like a gymnast, and the other clear across the room, landing on the end of a roommate's bed. No one stirred. He slid off the bed, pulled down his pajama pants and stomped on them, leaving them to cower on the ground. He ripped off his pyjama top, the buttons pinging away to different corners of the room, and stood there for a few moments, reveling in the glorious feeling of being mostly naked. He dressed himself by the street lamp light coming through the window. He put on his shoes. His skin tingled with decision. He ripped a marker off the clipboard that sat at the end of his bed and wrote, Carl the Touch Typist Wazir, in shaky letters, hugely, on the wall above his bed. He threw the marker up in the air and it clattered to the ground. After a moment's reflection, he picked up the marker and pocketed it. He placed his hat and gloves on the foot of the bed and waved to the four sleeping men. He peeked around the doorway and tiptoed down the hall. He opened the front door and stepped out into the night. And as he walked down the path and out the gate, he thought, this is the bravest thing I've done by far.
Part 2.
Carl, the touch typist. Carl sits at a desk in the police station, waiting for a police officer to attend to him. The station is not that different from typing school. Rows of desks, topped with